This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. A number of weeks back, a young, very talented artist stopped by our studios, and he ravished our airwaves with a rendition of Ernst Bloch's Prayer. You're listening to that performance now. He was a very talented young German cellist named Gabriel Schwabe, whose career at age 30 is starting to mature and bloom, and his two recent recordings, released on the Naxos label, the first of cello sonatas by Brahms, which also includes some arrangements of Brahms' songs for that combination by my guest, and the second, works for cello and orchestra by Camille Saint-Saëns, both have brought him acclaim and made an imprint in a world that's full of talented cellists. My guest grew up in a household of German-Spanish mix, an artistic family, so that my guest knew he would be playing an instrument, first piano, then violin, but for the moment his hands held a cello, that is what he wanted to play and how he wanted to make music. And then moving on to winning competitions and concertizing around the world and making recordings, he is forging that career that today is so promising. I spoke with Gabriel Schwabe while he was here at our studios a few weeks back. Very happy today to be here with cellist Gabriel Schwabe. Congratulations on the two now Naxos recordings. Brahms cello sonatas with some arrangements of songs for cello and piano, and then Saint-Saëns' two cello concertos with a lot of transcriptions and arrangements of things by Saint-Saëns. Start with the Brahms. As a composer, you've said you have a close affinity to. As we'll talk a little bit throughout the interview, cellists have a nice repertoire, but in comparison to violinists and pianists, it's still paltry. There's nothing. And even that it extends to cello sonatas. There's a lot of cello sonatas, big body, I'm from the Baroque period. But so these two sonatas that Brahms left, which are a gift, just talk about what they mean to a cellist in general and what they've meant to you over your career so far.
Yeah. So the two Brahms sonatas together with the five Beethoven sonatas are really the core repertoire for this combination, cello and piano. It's really fantastic to have these two pieces to dive into, and also to have an early work with the E minor sonata and a late work with the F major means that you get to explore Brahms at different stages of his life and his development as a composer. Yeah, and also for the instrument and the combination, especially cello with piano, they're amazingly written. The density of material, especially in the F major sonata, is unbelievable. But at the same time, he manages to always keep clear structure. So when you listen to the music, you always have a great overview of what's happening. And yeah, it's extremely gratifying to play that music.
For every serious cellist, these are going to be part of their repertoire.
Absolutely.
When did these come into your orbit? And is that sort of normal when a cellist starts to pick up the Brahms and start to learn the Brahms?
Well, the E minor sonata, I started playing relatively early when I was in my teens. And I think it was one of the first major works for cello and piano that I learned at that time. So that's been a work that has been around for much of my musical life. Yeah. And the F major sonata, I learned a bit later when I was studying. But still, it's also a piece that I've performed a lot, that I've worked a lot on. And for this recording, it was great to have Nicholas Rimmer as my partner, because from the moment we first met, we were put together to play at a festival, there was an immediate connection. Yeah. And I felt that he was really someone that I could connect to, not only musically, but also intellectually. I mean, the rehearsals were always good fun, but also very interesting. And we learn things from each other.
That's the best kind of collaboration.
Absolutely. And I think that's what you aim for, ultimately, in a musical partner.
The Saint-Saëns disc has the two concertos, number one and, depending on what your feelings are, number two, number one and then number two. But there's also some arrangements. Obviously, the Swan is here from Carnival Animals. There's an interesting piece, The Suite, from 1919, originally cello piano.
Yes.
This is really late Saint-Saëns, and that's saying something, because Saint-Saëns really outlived himself, basically, as a composer. But he didn't do a lot those last years that really stays in the repertoire. Talk about an inclusion of this piece. It's fascinating.
Yeah, The Suite is interesting because it's late and also early, because the first version for cello and piano is actually relatively early, Opus 16. And then the reworked version that is on this disc includes two movements that have been switched out. So from the original suite, there's three movements that are basically left the same, but in an orchestral arrangement. And then there's two completely new movements that he composed for it. And yeah, it's a very unusual piece, because it really follows the idea of a suite to have five movements of very contrasting character. And he also plays a lot with Baroque forms. We have a bourée in the middle, and also the tarantella in the last movement is a very unusual form to play on the cello. So it's very interesting, and also from the instrumentation, very well made, very colorful, and it's definitely a piece that's worth performing and hearing.
And Saint-Saëns, I mean, 1919, what the world had been through by 1919,
yes.
And it's still just Saint-Saëns.
Yes,
two great discs, sort of. Music at different ends of the European experience from 19th century for people to hear your artistry.
From his Naxos recording along with pianist Nicholas Rimmer of the two cello sonatas of Johannes Brahms, here is the first movement, marked Allegro Vivace, from Brahms's second sonata in F major, his Opus 99. Thank you.
I mentioned how the cellist doesn't have a huge repertoire in comparison. If you just stick to concertos, you have the Saint-Saëns, you know, Haydn, Dvorak, Schumann, Elgar, maybe Shostakovich, if you want to throw the Tchaikovsky Rococo in there, whatever. You know, it's this. It's very limited when you compare it to what the violinist can walk out on stage
with.
Or the pianist. However, you're concerned about that. I mean, I think just a little while back you premiered a new work for cello and orchestra. I mean, talk about your repertoire as a cellist with orchestra as far as the stable of pieces that you have to play and probably play a lot more, maybe a lot more than you'd like to, and what's new and what you're trying to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially as a cellist, it's interesting to have a project like the Saint-Saëns CD where not only you record the concerto number one, which is a staple of every cellist repertoire and everybody knows it well, but to also go a bit off-road and look into the other things that composer Saint-Saëns wrote. And that's why these kind of projects are a great experience for me, because first of all, you learn new repertoire that, you know, you can later perform in concert and do interesting programs with, but also you get a much better feeling for the composer. So that in turn affects how you play the standard repertoire. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. So I think that's one part of expanding the repertoire. And the other part, of course, is working with composers, which I like to do a lot. And to get a feeling for how a work is written in relation to what the person is like is always fascinating to me. Because,
but as far as works with cello and ensemble, a concerto type setup, whatever the other ensemble is, I mean, do you as a cellist, like I say, you just premiered this piece back in November, you mentioned it was, but I mean, do you like send the call out to composers and say, hey, you know, feel free to do a thing, you know?
Well, I do. I mean, I haven't so far commissioned a piece myself, but I've met lots of composers over the years. And of course, you get to talking about repertoire. They will send you scores and show things. And so whenever there is something that interests me and that I, you know, that I feel that I'd like to perform, I bring it up for orchestra, for promoters. Yeah, and I think it's extremely important to also find a good way to fit these works into maybe a more traditional program, because if you do, let's say, the specialist programs with only new music, that can also be, that's maybe a bit too specific for, it's for a certain audience.
Right.
But what I like to do is to include these works in a program that maybe has some Beethoven in it or Saint-Saëns or whatever music that is well known, and just add this contemporary color to it, which is always a great contrast to the rest of the program. And also many times after performing a program as such, the audience will come up to me and say that especially the contemporary work the one that was most interesting and that was really fascinating to them.
Yeah.
So that's always a great experience.
Yeah, I agree.
Turning to my guest's other new release on the Naxos label of works for cello and orchestra by Camille Saint-Saëns, from that rarity, the Suite in D Minor, a work originally for cello and piano that Saint-Saëns came back to late in life in 1919 and orchestrated, and added two movements, and we'll hear those two additions, a gavotte and a tarantelle, performed by my guest Gabriel Schwabe, who is accompanied by the Malmö Symphony Orchestra, Mark Sustro conducts.
Thank you.
About you, the great cellists I've had on this program over the past years, there's always an interesting path they take to get to the cello. Some have had brothers and sisters older than them that grab the violin and piano first, so the cello was the choice. And then, of course, the viola comes after for the even younger
kids. Right.
But, I mean, was cello going to be your choice? Was it the only choice? And then the dovetail question, especially for somebody your age, and in your age, there are so many choices of what you could do with yourself these days, especially with technology. Was music going to be that choice? Take us through all those.
Yeah. So, well, it all started with my mother being a piano teacher. So music was always around, and it was out of the question that, you know, my sister is a bit younger than me, and I would learn an instrument. So the natural choice was the piano, which came first. And so, yeah, after a while of learning the piano, my mother thought it would be good to learn a string instrument. So naturally, I learned the violin because it was the obvious choice. And the cello was a bit of a coincidence for me because the elementary school that I went to had a program that offered learning instruments for the kids at school. And that's where I first came across a cello. And to be honest, the only reason I was fascinated with it in the beginning was the size of it. So I just thought it's great, you know, to be carrying around exactly to be carrying around such a big instrument, which now in hindsight, especially for traveling, may not have been the best choice. But yeah, so that's how I got interested in the cello, and I started and picked it up. And very soon I realized that I had a much more natural connection to this instrument. So I had a much more natural way of expressing myself. I could vibrate almost immediately, which I couldn't do on the violin. So there were many things that I felt were much more for me with the cello. And yeah, so that's how it all started. And by the time I was around 14, 15, I knew that this was what I wanted to do with my life.
We'll take the next step here. We should back up since you mentioned your mom. You come from a pretty interesting temperamental mix of Spanish and German, which are interesting temperaments to grow up with, maybe in the home.
Yes.
How do they reflect themselves in your person?
Well, I'm very grateful to have had this this great mix as a background when growing up, because at home, not only we spoke both languages, but we ate food from both countries. And so it was a very, very rich cultural environment to grow up in. And I think, of course, it's hard to pin down exactly which temperament reflects itself where in your own personality. But definitely what I got was a passion also for Spanish music, because we listened to a lot of it back home and also started playing it as a young age. So this is something that I like to have in my repertoire. And there are also great cello pieces by, you know, Casado and the likes that are great to play, well written for the instrument. So yeah, that is something that I like to do. And I also think that it reflects, especially having these both languages spoken at home, it reflects on the sound. Of course, it's a very complex thing to draw parallels. But I do think that speaking Spanish gives a certain type of articulation that you look for, and a certain density in the sound.
Probably that nationality thing only comes out when something bad happens. They say, oh, that's the German side, that's the Spanish.
Exactly.
When there's something in the Thank you.
once again from my guest, cellist Gabriel Schwabe's new Naxos recording of music for cello and orchestra by Camille Saint-Saëns with the Malmö Symphony Orchestra conducted by Marc Soustro. Some of the best known music for cello, the Swan Movement from Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals in the version for cello and orchestra by Paul Vidal.
So you're in your teens, you've decided on cello, you win some awards, you've competitions and things like that. At what point did you decide solo career rather than sitting in the cello section of an orchestra or part of a string quartet? Where was that decision made? How was it?
Yeah, well, that never was a decision per se. It's something that developed naturally because, you know, I was doing competitions, I was doing rather well. And so I got to play as a soloist from an early age also. And I realized that I loved that part of the aspect of playing the instrument. Because, of course, it's great also to play, you know, playing in an orchestra can be a great experience, can be great fun. But obviously, if you sit in front of the orchestra and have to kind of battle with this huge monster of sound behind you, that's challenging. But, of course, it makes for some great musical experiences if it works out well. Yeah, so I like the challenge of being the sole knight in front of the orchestra. Yeah, so I'm very glad that it worked out that way for me.
Were there cellists you saw as that you know, they had a career doing this that you not emulated, but, you know, sort of kind of even mental mentors of just, I can do this, you know? Were there cellists that sort of drew your attention that way?
You mean like
a choice to be a soloist, to have a career as a solo cellist?
In terms of having role models,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to a lot of Rostropovich when I was young, of course, because he was the all-encompassing figure in the cello world. Yeah, later on, there were other influences. I mean, I've always had a strong affinity for the violin. So also nowadays, when I listen to music, many times it will be violinists. Mm-hmm. So Heifetz, Zuckermann, all of these people I like to listen to for the sound. But yeah, and then I also started appreciating Feuermann as a cellist, who has such an amazing ability for the instrument. But this elegance in sound is something that I find extremely appealing. So there were, of course, over the years, many different people that I looked up to. And not last, of course, to mention my teachers, Katharine Ilea and Franz Helmerson, that guided me during my study years. So yeah, it was a good mix of influences.
I usually don't go here with string players, especially violinists, because you can get into the weeds. so quickly when you talk about their instruments and the history of their instruments. It can get, you know, glazing over as they talk about this. But one of the instruments you play, it's on loan to you to play, is a cello, but it's really old for any string instrument, but for a cello, it's really old. So tell us about it.
Yeah, well, so the cello I play is unique in the sense not only that it's very old, it's made around 1600, so there are very few instruments that survive from that period, but also in the sense that it's made in Brescia, and these early instruments from the Brescian school, they're very rare overall, but especially cellos are very rare to find. Yeah, it was a coincidence, as so many things in life, that I met a collector that had this instrument in his collection and wasn't being played at the time. So, we got to talking, and he invited me over to try the instrument, see if it would be a match. And it was. So I'm very lucky to have had this for the last 4 years now to play on. Yeah, and it's a great instrument. It has this warmth in the tone, but also kind of throaty strength in its tone, and it's something that I really love to play on.
Being played, I mean, that's what the instrument's for, right?
Absolutely, they have to be played.
Again, on the recording made by my guest Anaxos of the two Brahms cello sonatas, this the final movement from the first of the two sonatas that had a gap of 21 years between their composition. This sonata in E minor, composed when Brahms was the age of my guest, and performing here cellist Gabriel Schwabe along with pianist Nicholas Rimmer.
From very old to very new, you turning 30 this year.
That's right.
And I don't even remember that from my life. That's okay. But yet you have a real passion for making sure musicians even younger than you have music education. Talk a little bit about what you've done and how important this is to you to get into young musicians and teach them.
Yeah, so I've had a passion for teaching actually for a long time, and I think it stems from the fact that I've had fantastic teaching myself. So you know, that grows a desire in you to give back to the next generation. Yeah, so I've given masterclasses. I've actually co-founded a series of masterclasses in Berlin, which we held for the first time last year and was a great experience. And I feel that, yeah, it's important to be in touch with younger people, not only because you learn something yourself, actually, when teaching. You start reflecting a little bit more than you would if you're just playing, about how you do certain things and how to transmit the concepts and ideas that are behind your playing to other people. So that's very gratifying. And also I feel that, you know, when you reach a certain age like I have now, that I feel that really I have developed a style that of course keeps developing every day, but that still is something I can call my own. It's something that I like to transmit, not for other people to imitate, but to transmit the general ideas that are behind, because I think that that's something that other people might, you know, benefit from. And
because of your age, when you're talking to, let's say, an 18, 19 year old, someone in their teens, you're closer to their age than many of their teachers
yeah.
are. You also might have a better grasp of what they're dealing with in their life, how they proportion things like the technology that they use on. I mean, that helps you communicate to them, with them, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Of course, you have to find a good balance yeah. between, you know, maintaining a certain authority, of course, when you're teaching, because it doesn't work otherwise, but also having this aspect of closeness in age and, yeah, and certain type of mindset helps the students identify mm-hmm. also what you're doing. And yeah, I think it's a great thing to do.
Before we get to the last two questions, which I ask every single one of my guests, I have to go to the question I've asked every cellist.
Oh, good.
I've had over the years, because the music that you've been left, you mentioned the Beethoven cellos, now we've talked about the Brahms, we've mentioned some of the concertos, but the Bible of those Bach cello suites, I've asked every cellist what they mean in their life. How do they use them? Where do they fall? And the answers have really covered the spectrum too. Every morning I wake up and it's the first thing I do.
Yeah.
You know, I use them when I have to, whatever, all the whole range. That's the question to you. I mean, what do they mean to you as far as how you use them in
yeah.
your career?
I mean, for me, it's repertoire that I always come back to in a sense or other. So even if it's music that I'm not performing at the moment, because I might have other things on my schedule, I will still here and there pick up the music and just play through something to develop the ideas, because it's also one of the pieces I think that has changed the most over the years in the way I approach it, in the way I think about it, and in the way I play it ultimately. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good indicator of where you are for yourself, just artistically, to be working on the music and see how you've developed, actually, because that's...
So you let yourself come to the pieces, which shows how much you've matured as an artist.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, yeah, so, yeah, it's...
The matches on a door, you know.
In a sense, yes, yeah, in a sense, because it's
a different take.
Yeah.
So we'll hear my guest play Bach,
the Sarabande and Gigue from the Cello Suite No. 1. Remember, this is March and our Bach 500 campaign. We're looking for 500 donations in any amount to the Classical Network to reach our goal by Bach's birthday next Wednesday, March 21st. Is your donation already in our tally? You can make it so now at our website, wwfm.org. Just click donate, and thank you.
Ahead, what are things that you want to do in the next few years, either on the recording end of it, since we started there with recordings? I mean, what's up with your career here? You got a long career ahead of you.
So there are a few exciting things coming in the next months. There is a Schumann recording, which is in the last stages of getting the cover done and everything. So it will be released in May. And I'm very excited about this because Schumann is a composer that I feel that you need such a personal approach to, and took me some time to find my way in this music. And I'm excited to have recorded this with the Royal Northern Symphonia and Lars Vogt as a conductor, which I thought was a great combination of musical partners to have for this repertoire. So I'm very much looking forward to this release. Will be on Naxos as well. Yeah, and in concerts, I'm going to Beijing next month to give my orchestra debut there, which will be very exciting because I've been to China before, but I've played chamber music mainly. So yeah, it's great to be in this fantastic new hall that looks like a spaceship. Well, that's another challenge. I will be playing both Haydn concertos in one concert, which I've never done before also.
Well, congratulations on that. Congratulations on the new CD.
Thank you.
To the two questions I ask all my guests, which is the first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops in your head? Don't think about it long enough.
That's a very good question. Well, I'd say Heifetz, probably.
Heifetz?
Yeah.
You did go back to the
Yeah.
Yeah, such a consummate master. I mean,
yeah.
Unlike like Horowitz on the piano had idiosyncrasies, Heifetz just sort of controlled everything on the instrument.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you want Piatigorsky in the room?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You got a very busy career going. But when you have to step away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, just you know, a little respite, what do you do when you need to get away for a little while?
Well, you know, first of all, I always make sure that I have at least 2 weeks of holiday a year where I don't touch the instrument, which is good
that's
to get
it. German side talking.
Absolutely.
When you eat at 10,
yes,
that's your
yeah.
Spanish side talking. But when you take the 2 weeks, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's important, I think, to just clear your mind a bit and also you know, have some relaxation for the muscles. And I think that's important. But other than that, yeah, I don't have any crazy hobbies, so to speak. I don't build model planes or anything. What I like to do is spend time with my fiance, with my family, cook something, and just spend time with those that I love being around.
Well, again, best as your career goes, Gabriel Schrappi. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cellist Gabriel Schwabe. You can find out more about him at his website, Gabriel. Schwabe is schwabe.com. His recordings are on the Naxos label. You can check them out at naxos.com and watch for his Schumann disc available this May. I'll leave you with, again, music from his Naxos disc of music for cello and orchestra by the great French composer Camille Saint-Saëns, the closing minutes of the famous Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor from 1872. The Malmö Symphony Orchestra is led by Marc Soustrot, the soloist, my guest today, cellist Gabriel Schwabe. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical, and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.